Welcome to the Shmoola.com podcast, episode number one. Today, we're going to speak with Eric Rees, the author of The Lean Startup. This interview is sponsored by HireVue, the leading digital recruiting and interaction platform provider. Top brands, including 14 of Fortune's world's most admired companies, use HireVue to transform their hiring processes with digital technology when connecting with top talent to fill open positions. Independent research shows that companies using HireVue can expect significant gains throughout the hiring process, including a 13% increase in hiring of top performers, a 23% decrease in overall cost per hire, and a 29% reduction in employee turnover. In short, HireVue's digital interaction platform allows companies to discover better quality talent in a shorter time and at a lower cost. Visit HireVue.com today. So Eric, first off, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Just wanted to give you some context, I guess, before we begin. So I've been in the lean world for a while. I started at Toyota and I've worked at Amazon and eBay, and I've done consulting for other companies and industries. And I have to tell you, man, in my years, I haven't seen so much excitement about lean as I do about the lean startup movement. There's lots of excitement around it. Even old timers like Art Smalley, Matt May, Michael Ballet, Emily Yanni, they're all speaking really positively about it. So,
oh, thank you.
So nice work on that.
Thank you. And thanks for asking them about it on the record. It's been great. A lot of those guys, I don't know them at all. So I didn't know what they thought of it. So it's been really cool for me to see all that happening.
Yeah, it's been really neat to see their responses. They're very excited about it. And, you know, in the words of Matt May, he said that, you know, the lean startup, what he sees is really the true spirit of lean, where it's not focused on tools, but really on the principles, and they can be applied anywhere, really. And so it's been really cool.
It was very, very meaningful for me to hear that. I really, that's so much what we strive for, in the lean startup movement. And to hear that recognized by one of the old guard was really, it was a treat. So thank you.
You bet.
For making that happen.
Awesome. Well, let me jump to my questions. I want to begin and talk about FastWorks. There's a lot of buzz around it, and I think it's actually really, really cool. So GE's partnered with you to help them build FastWorks. So let me read a quote and get your reaction to it. So this is from Mark Little, head of GE Global Research. He said, "We're looking at young Eric, thinking, how the hell is this software dude going to have anything to say to us? And yet his ideas were transformational. I went in completely skeptical about it, and I came away completely enthused." So you pitch to the old guard. These guys are super seasoned. You pitch to GE CEO Jeff Immelt. Were you freaking out?
Oh, totally. Oh, yeah, I was very nervous. And, and I didn't know what this was going to become. You know, my background is in software, as Mark said. It is in Silicon Valley, and I didn't. You know, I had written in my book that entrepreneurship is a kind of management, and that lean startup was, you know, a way to manage in the situations of high uncertainty that every kind of company faces. And I made this kind of relatively grandiose claim that it could be used by companies of any size, scale, industry, sector, you know, like all business authors do. But I didn't know whether people in those situations would actually take me seriously or not. You know, it was a deduction. It was a hypothesis. That I was very confident in, but you know, it's one thing to be confident of it, you know, when you're sitting down to write something. It's quite another thing for people who are full-time practitioners whose job depends on, delivering results to take it seriously. And, the first time I presented to Jeff Immelt, I told the story must have been to Business Week. I just did a profile about it. And they were, you know, asking me the same question. Was I nervous? And I said, the way you know I was nervous is I wore a suit. which in Silicon Valley you never do, but I'm being summoned to the legendary facility at GE at Cronenville. You know, this is the meeting was with Jeff and his top, pretty much his top 200 managers in the world, so the most senior people in the entire company. And, consulting with my wife, decided, you know, to wear a suit. And of course, I show up in a suit. I'm not making this up. Jeff Immelt starts making fun of me. My first interaction with him, I was dressed more formally than he was. He was,
awesome.
You know, he was not dressed nearly as formally as I was, and he was teasing me, "What'd you wear a suit for?" You know, guy from Silicon Valley, because of course they're expecting hoodie and a jeans, you know, and something a little bit more flippant. And so I don't know if they took it as a sign of respect or what, but yeah, I was quite nervous.
That's awesome. Well, I come from the world where you can't dress in it too formally, so I think that's awesome. Well, how's FastWorks going now?
I think it's been incredibly, incredibly successful. I think, you know, certainly far beyond my expectations. And a lot of the most successful stories about it, you know, I feel like it's not really my place to tell. As with all my clients, you know, I want to respect their confidentiality, and that's what gives them the safety to kind of, you know, have really candid conversations with me. So I try to follow their lead in, you know, what they say publicly. But, you know, if you look at the videos, like from the Lean Startup Conference last year, we had some people from GE there to present. Like I said, that there's been that piece in Business Week. So there's been some public acknowledgement of the fact that this has had a tremendously positive impact on the company. And, you know, to the point that Jeff Immelt has said he wants this to be the new operating system going forward for how they do work.
Wow.
Which
that's,
you know, for a company that has had so much experience with Lean and obviously the very famous or infamous episode with Six Sigma, depending on your point of view. But one thing you can't argue with those past episodes is that they were, of course, leaving out Workout, which isn't even, it's kind of fallen out of favor now, but was a very big deal in it today.
Yeah.
One thing you say about GE is when they adopt a new methodology from the outside, they really take it seriously. They really make it their own, and they deploy it full scale. You know, they don't do things halfway. And what I think most people don't realize maybe about something like FastWorks is just how much work it is. Like, so how it's incredibly hard. You know, of course they bring in outside people like me, but the real work is done by the internal team, the full-time internal team that is driving this change to the company. And I think what people don't realize and should is that it's not just for product development. So we've done really cool things, you know, healthcare, super high-tech healthcare devices, deep sea drilling, energy, fracking. I've learned all about the deep world of the industrial capitalism through my experience with GE, but appliances before they sold the division, did quite a few things with them. Lighting, you name it, they make it. We've done FastWorks projects on it. But there's also, that's only half the story. There's also the work to transform all the internal initiatives. So IT, new IT systems that are still done the old waterfall way, changing those teams to work with a customer service mentality and really test and iterate. Finance, legal, HR, all, they think about all the functions, the commercial functions and sales and marketing. I mean, it has been a company-wide effort. And so it's really engaging people all over the company, not just to, you know, people say, oh, you just put it like, so it seems like such a cliche, like put up posters and say, oh, I think like an entrepreneur and be more creative and whatever. And like, I even feel silly talking about it, but the truth is we've had thousands of employees of the company who have felt free, I think, in some cases for the first time, to really do things in a different way, to really take the good ideas that were there before, but actually have the freedom and opportunity to implement them. And so it's been really an incredibly moving experience to be able to witness.
That's awesome. Nice job on that. Now,
thank you.
You know, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of these folks, they're familiar with Deming and Plan, Do, Check, Act. I'm just curious from a technical perspective, when you taught them build, measure, learn, they were, I'm sure, able to see some the influence that PDCA had on your work. What was some of
yeah.
their reaction to that?
Well, I mean, Mark Little is a great example. You know, who you started with. He, you know, he is a deeply technical person, and one of the first projects we did at GE was a very technical energy project that involves, like, you know, hardcore material science, hardcore engineering, hardcore supply chain and manufacturing. Like, it was significant. Very expensive project in the context of the company. And so when you have a bunch of engineers in the room and a bunch of technical people in the room, in addition to the corporate VPs and the other like business bigwigs, one thing I've learned is you really can't BS your way through it. You know, you got to know what you're talking about, and you have to be able to answer the questions that they have, namely, how does this relate to, and then you got, you know, and all kinds of stuff come out of their mouth next, right? Like, how does it relate to this concept from Six Sigma? How does it relate to, you know, the way we do supply chain, manufacturing, science, discovery? And to be fair, even the marketing and, you know, customer research type people, like, they have really hardcore specialty as well. And you have to really understand the connections between ideas. And so I think that it's a great strength for a company like GE that has that background in PDCA and who understands Lean. That's a strength, because you can say, listen, this builds on a set of tools that you're familiar with, but moves them into a new domain that you're not as familiar with, and let me draw you those connections. So, I mean, manufacturing companies, any company that really understands manufacturing, you know, you can say, you know, we all know that work in progress inventory is bad. We don't want to have excess work in progress inventory. Our goal is to achieve single piece flow and to drive down buffers, and, you know, all those concepts will be familiar to people. It's like, great. So now think of, visualize the hypotheses that we have about a new product or any new initiative for that matter. Every untested hypothesis is a form of inventory.
That's awesome.
And so if you go, you work for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, I was working with one project where they, you know, 5 years of planning and research and implementation before they were going to launch to customers. So that means 5 years of massive numbers of hypotheses just piling up. But unlike on the shop floor, the problem with intangible inventory is you don't see it. So you don't have that visceral feeling of this is incredibly wasteful. You know, where are we going to store all this inventory? Like, you know, all those kind of very concrete and kind of easy to understand stories that, that traditional lean books are full of. Here, since you can't see the inventory, part of the challenge is helping the company understand their own process well enough to be able to visualize what's going on. So you can ask people who are familiar with the manufacturing metaphor to kind of do a leap of imagination and say, look, here, all these untested assumptions, all these, you know, unimplemented designs are one of my favorites. You know, people spend years designing something, but if it hasn't yet been implemented, if we haven't put it to the test of reality, then how do we know if the design is any good? All this inventory just piling up everywhere, and then, you know, it's not enough to tell people that the way that they do things today is a problem. You got to, you know, just like any lean transformation, you got to point the direction to say, we can take those same tools that you already know, you know, all the Kaizen tools, you know, all of, you know, think about Kanban and Encore and you name it, they have their analog in lean startup, and we can apply that same set of that same expertise to this new domain where that will give you an advantage if you're willing to make the conceptual leap. And I think that's what Mark's talking about. You know, I remember very well the first time he was in the audience. You know, we were working with one of his teams, and he was very skeptical, and he asked very tough questions. That guy's very smart. And you could see the light bulb go on where he's like, okay, I got it. This is not just some random fad that some business person, you know, said, oh, hey, we should, like, get on the bandwagon. There's some substance here. And, you know, let's experiment to see if it'll really work in our context. And that's the other thing I really admire about GE and a number of my clients that have been willing to do this. I'd be very suspicious if someone called me in and said, you know, on day one, we want to do this company-wide. CEO is going to make the official directive. We're just going to say everyone has to do it. We're going to make everybody read your book. I mean, of course, I'd be flattered. But I don't think it would be effective because we haven't actually run the experiment yet to figure out, does this work for this particular industry, for this particular business? How do we customize it? How do we use the right language to describe it? How do we connect it to the initiatives that people know and the systems that people understand? Like that was a lot of work that has to happen to kind of both create the internal proof points, but also create that translation that makes, you know, that's why we call it FastWorks. Like, it is a special program indigenous to GE that is, you know, customized for their culture and environment.
Well, it sounds like, you know, by you being able to build on a set of common beliefs, that seems to have built a lot of trust.
I think so. I mean, I come in for criticism not infrequently for calling it Lean Startup. You know, that is not a very popular choice. As it's become more famous, you know, the criticism is more or less dried up, but every once in a while someone will say you should have called it something different. And my response has always been the same, you know, from the very first days when I was trying to explain this to software people, many of them had never heard of lean manufacturing. The reason it's called Lean Startup is for one, and only one reason, which is that it actually does build on this conceptual machinery from the lean movement that was incredibly helpful in forming my own sense of how this was going to work. And so, you know, what I want is for people to be able to learn more. I think that's kind of the obligation of anybody who's trying to set up, you know, create a new set of ideas, is you got to be able to give people the map that shows how your ideas connect to other ideas. And if they want to go deeper, you got to be able to point them the way. And, you know, it just seems ludicrous for me to be like, I came up with everything. It's all brand new. If somebody wants to go look at wants to go understand the Deming, you know, underpinnings of this whole thing, you know, I feel like it's my obligation to kind of give them the signpost that said, hey, that's an important direction to take it. So,
cool.
Yeah, I feel like that was a very important choice, both, you know, for my own intellectual integrity, but that has had these very practical benefits as well.
No, it makes a lot of sense. My colleague here, Ben, has a couple of questions for you.
Sure.
Hey, Eric, I'm a big fan. I stumbled across your book on my own, and I think I've gone through it three times.
Oh, thank you.
Just while road biking and stuff, and I love the examples you have, and just the concepts really motivate people to almost go into startup mode, which is pretty fun. But the question I had for you is, I'm sure you've dealt with this when you're working with a team of software engineers, and you get kind of split decisions where there's doing it quickly and there's doing it right. So yep. The example I might give is, you can hard code the SQL statements in your code, or you can use something like SQL Alchemy or some object-oriented approach that's maybe a standard approach. So how do you navigate something like that with a brand new startup and you have no product? How much rework are you willing to take to push a product out?
Yeah. I appreciate getting a software question. It's, after all this time lately in manufacturing, it's fun to go back to, I consider that my home. In hard coding the SQL statement, I've had that specific argument with people how many times in my career, I can't even count. It's always tough. So, you know, everybody knows time, quality, money, pick two. I was taught that as a young engineer that, you know, the business people never seem to understand that you can't have it all. And it was actually a revelation to me. When, you know, one of the things I loved about reading the original books I read about Lean was to learn that saying is not a law of nature. It is an artifact of a specific way of working. And if you change the system, you can change the trade-offs that are available to be able to get better ones. And, you know, the classic Lean trade-off is that you really can't trade quality for speed because, you know, defects slow you down. So, you know, even if you think you can make that trade, you really can't. So the corresponding concept in the world of software, we talk about technical debt. And those of your listeners or readers who are familiar with software will know all about technical debt. For those who are new to it, it's a very simple concept. It says if you don't do things the right way, and you got to imagine that capitalized R, capitalized W, the right way, then what happens is over time the software gets more and more crufty, more and more difficult to change. You have more and more bugs and problems because you've been hacking and kind of kludging your way. Picture, you know, the duct tape and the baling wire and the whole thing. And so eventually you have to pay that debt back. So that's why it's an analogy to financial debt. It seems like if you borrow money, it's like free money. Ooh, I can spend a lot of money today. I can get a few extra features today. But over time, if you keep borrowing money, eventually interest payments are going to kill you. That's the analogy of technical debt. So one of the big insights that I had in developing Lean Startup was something that really shocked me. Unlike financial debt, technical debt has some very strange properties. And there's one property that is unique to the startup situation, which is that some technical debts never come due. Like, imagine how cool that would be if you went to a bank and you borrowed $10,000 and you got a notice the next day the bank has become insolvent and you never have to pay the $10,000 back. It's your money, keep it. I mean, in the world of finance, that very rarely happens. But in the world of technical, that happens all the time, and I'll tell you why. Sometimes in a startup situation, we build a feature that customers don't want. And then the right thing to do is to throw it away. So if we'd spent extra time building it the right way, capital R, capital W, that would have been wasted time because it turned out we were going to throw the whole feature away. Now, that's very strange. People are not used to taking that into account, and there's an assumption, a deep assumption in most engineering cultures, that you always know what the right way is, and that the thing you're working on is always going to be valuable to customers, therefore you never have to face this trade-off. But there's an even worse strange thing about technical debt that is kind of unique to the startup situation. In some situations, we don't know what the right way is in advance. This one really bothered me. So I'll give you a story. I was once working in a startup, writing the software myself. I was the CTO. You know, it was very, very important to me that the software be high quality. And the way that we thought the software was going to go to market was to interoperate with 10 different third-party systems. I won't get into the details, but we had to write an incredible amount of code to interoperate with these 10 different systems. This is before the days of clean, beautiful REST APIs and all kinds of nice interoperability standards. This was kludge and reverse engineering and just a total nightmare to get all this code to integrate with the 10 systems. But the payoff was that therefore we wouldn't have to build the systems ourselves. We could leverage all this infrastructure that was out there already. And in order to do that, we had to make a lot of very important architectural trade-offs, and I was very keen that things should be done the right way. So everything in our system was refactored so that which transport you were using to send messages, you know, it was platform independent. And there was all this indirection and object-oriented code that allowed you to kind of swap different systems in and out. It was very elegant, very beautiful architecture, if I do say so myself. So if you'd asked me, you know, is there a lot of technical debt in this system? I would have said no. I mean, there are other aspects of the system that had technical debt in it, but this particular system, I was very proud of. It was a very core focus of us. We knew it was going to be critical to the company. High quality was very important. Very good unit test coverage, you name it. Well, two or three pivots later, it turns out that the strategy, the business strategy of interoperating with other systems was a mistake. And we had to throw all that code away because turned out there was no alternative to building the system ourselves. So I won't get into the details, but suffice to say, instead of interoperating with somebody else's system, we were going to build our own full stack implementation of all the transport layers ourselves.
Wow.
So, that was pretty painful because all I have is interoperability code that got thrown away. So that's an example of what I was talking about before, technical debt that never comes due. Whatever technical debt was in that system was removed by the fact that it was thrown away. But now think about the architectural choices that we had made, the ones I was really proud of, having really thought through and done the right way, all this indirection and objects. And once you don't have to interoperate with more than one system, every ounce of that indirection, all that architecture went from optimal to suboptimal. And it actually introduced all this new technical debt we didn't know about. And in fact, engineers who were hired into the company later thought I was a complete idiot. Because they're like, why did you build this terrible architecture? You should have done it the right way. And I'm like, you don't understand. It was the right way at that time, but the use case changed. And they never believed me. They're just like, well, if I had been here, I would have been able to anticipate. It's like, yeah, I'm sure you're right. So in a startup, the calculation on technical debt is complicated by these two factors. One, some technical debts never come due. And two, sometimes the right way becomes the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a very counterintuitive way to solve this problem. And I advocate for a system, that is based in Lean Startup that I think really addresses this. It's very controversial and a lot of engineers just don't want to do it. The article I wrote about it originally was called Embrace Technical Debt, which I thought was going to get me lynched by my fellow engineers. Here's the idea. Technical debt is not bad. The question is, what do you spend the technical debt on? In the traditional formulation, you spend technical debt on features. So you hack instead of doing the beautiful right way SQL indirection object-oriented thing that you were describing, we just hack a SQL statement hard-coded. That saves us, a little bit of time. We use that a little bit of time to build an extra feature. Now, that if you keep doing that, that will eventually kill you, a startup or no. But what if we spent the technical debt, what if we borrowed the money and invested it in process and infrastructure so that we could go faster? And this goes back to the production system. What if we actually spent our own resources, instead of on more throughput, on quality improvement, built into the systems that we create? So what if every code deploy had the equivalent of an end-on cord on it? And any kind of problems that are created are automatically reverted. We call that system the cluster immune system at my past company. And we built in this system called continuous deployment, and it's an investment to be able to deploy as quickly as we could. We could do a deployment in about 10 minutes. We'd do it about 50 times a day on average. And when I say a full deployment, I mean literally an engineer writes a piece of code, checks it in directly to the trunk. There's no branches. That piece of code is transferred directly to production and goes through an incredible battery of tests and automation to make sure that the system is fine afterwards, including the business metrics and everything that's important to the company. And if anything goes wrong, it's automatically reverted. So here's the idea. Instead of building more features, build better process, better tools. Because those, if you're able to respond more quickly to what the market needs, to changes in use case, if you're able to change architectures quickly and easily, then that makes you more resilient to the accumulation of debt, to unexpected debts that you didn't know you were going to have to pay. And of course, it makes it less painful when you have to throw stuff out because you didn't spend so much time polishing it. So just to give you one more example of the system in operation. Again, think back to time, quality, money, pick two. And then think with that lens through the story I'm about to tell you. In my last startup called InView, we had a period of incredibly rapid growth when we went to from thousands of customers to millions over the course of only a few months. It was a very rapid S-curve, you know, the kind of growth most startups dream about. And our technical infrastructure at the start of that surge was very primitive. I'm talking about single master database. And effectively, one server ran the whole site. At the end, we had a very, very hardcore, horizontally partitioned, sharded. This is all pre-cloud computing, so pre-AWS. You had to build servers and physically stick them in a data center, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we had a very cool architecture afterwards. And here's how we got there. We called it just-in-time scalability. Every week, our product was used peak usage on the weekends in those days. So on Sunday would be peak time, and the site would be on the verge of falling over from a technical point of view on Sunday. So we come in Monday morning. We had an operations team that would analyze what happened over the weekend. They would look at the components of the architecture that seemed like they were about to fall over, all the bottlenecks and places that were kind of approaching red zone. And we would make a plan. We would say, how much more capacity do we have to have added to the site to survive the coming weekend? And that's not just adding servers, right? In a lot of cases, we had to go in and refactor the code so that, say, like one of my favorite examples is the users table. Every site has this. There's a critical table that's like who has an account in the system. It's like core, deep in the system. Most engineers are scared to death to touch the users table. Because you make a mistake there, you know, you can have spooky action at a distance. Any part of the site can fail as a result of touching that deep stuff. So people are usually afraid of it. But we didn't have fear because we had all this tools and infrastructure to support us. So we would go in and say, okay, this week it's time to refactor the users table so that it no longer resides on a single master database, but it's horizontally sharded across 20 databases. And we would build, implement, and test the new architecture on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Generally, we would deploy it on Thursday, and that would give us Friday to kind of make sure that it seemed like it was working okay, and we would go into the weekend. And we would do that every week for months, just in time, figuring out what needs to be refactored and what can we leave the same. And the architecture at the end was, of course, way better than it was at the start. It looked mostly like the architecture diagram we had set out at the beginning. Like, we did have a vision for what we wanted the architecture to look like. But a lot of the details were different. Like, if you had asked me at the start, for a site with, you know, 50 million customers, which in those days was a lot. I know everything's been inflated as the web grows bigger. What percentage of the data can live on the central master versus what percentage has to be partitioned? I would have told you, you know, 90% of the tables need to be partitioned. But as it turned out, it was only more like 20%. It's just a way of saying that you can't always tell what's going to be needed unless you study the system itself. So it goes back to the old Toyota production system saying that every defect is a treasure. That used to drive me crazy. I hated that saying for so long. It seems like such a zen crap, you know, like, I hate defects. You can't convince me that they're treasure, but I eventually learned, of course, the deep truth that's there, which is that the problems that you're having with your system, and the system is defined as the combination of technical and human components together. The whole system is trying to teach you where it needs intervention, and that's why root cause analysis and 5 whys and all that stuff is so powerful. So anyway, that's a very long answer to a short and simple question, but I think it's important because there is no simple answer to those kinds of questions, and it's why people spend so much time and energy trapped in these false dichotomies, having these stupid debates that, you know, I wish I could have all those hours of my life back.
Yeah. I appreciate the response. That was great. And I had one more question for you. This one will be less technical, but I think a lot of your fans will appreciate this question because they are in startup mode. So assume you're doing a new startup right now. It's a software startup. You're writing on Amazon or something, and you need to decide which vertical to chase. You don't have a product. There's lots of verticals available out there. How are you going to choose a vertical? Are you going to hit all of them? Or are you going to hit a few? What would that process look like, and what advice would you give to your readers?
Sure.
On finding the right vertical?
Yeah, I'm having this is not hypothetical for me. I am, in fact, building a startup, and I am having this very debate as we speak. So I'm struggling through this myself, and it's always hard. So it's actually very difficult to answer this question in the abstract. So the first answer is you got to look at the specifics of any given situation, because you know, different products have different strategies that make more sense for them. But in general, when we have a series of verticals that we could choose, a series of customer segments that we could target, I'm a big fan of targeting narrowly at the beginning. So kind of first question is, should I target many segments or just one? It's very easy, especially when people are trying to build a platform-type product, to build a product that's kind of like 80% good for many, many, many different use cases, but it's not really 100% good for any specific use case. Call it the platform disease. That's a situation I know a lot of tech companies find themselves in. There's actually a whole section in the great book, Crossing the Chasm, just about this that says, hey, by the way, if you're building a platform product, like, don't make this mistake. You have to build a product that is useful for somebody before it can be useful for everybody. So I'm a believer in narrow targeting rather than going for more broad application, even if your eventual goal is to build a broad platform. Then, okay, so I'm going to target a segment, but how do I choose which one? And there's kind of two principles that are key. The first is we got to target an early adopter first. So when we think about a segment, we got to think about how urgent is the problem that we're solving for this segment. Is it like hair on fire, critically important, or is it kind of a nice to have? We want to pick someplace where it's critically important. So there's a whole literature on early adopters, you know, in Recrossing the Chasm, or Steve Blank has a great chapter on early evangelists, he called them. And there's a lot of people who've written about this. I won't belabor that point. So we're going to start with an early adopter. And then the second criteria is, how quickly can we learn from this segment? So not all, you know, if you say you have three or four different early adopter potential categories, how do you pick one to go target? And that is a little bit more difficult. That requires really understanding those customers to figure out who's going to be willing to make a decision quickly, who has a sales cycle that I can address in a short amount of time, where are their distribution channels that I can access? So, you know, classic in a consumer company, is there certain segments you can only reach if you have premier distribution in a really high-end store? And there's some segments you can just reach online with Google AdWords. All other things being equal, we're going to choose the Google AdWords. So those are the two criteria. How important is this problem for this segment, and how quickly can we access them? But there's a meta point that's really important. Do not succumb to analysis paralysis here. Because my guess is, those of you who are listening are actually in this situation right now, your segmentation analysis that you're doing right this second is wrong. I bet you it's wrong. And I bet you a year from now, when you look back on what you used to think was segmentation, you're going to laugh. And it can be wrong in multiple ways. One is, it's very common to be wrong about who the early adopters are. Like, I've made this mistake all the time. You know, I say, okay, the segments are laid out this way. There's teenagers and adults, and I'm going to go after the adults. Oops, it's the teenagers, or vice versa. But it's also possible for the type of segmentation you're doing to just be the wrong conceptual framework. Like, I was working on a product that we had segmented by age when it turned out that age was not relevant. We had 40-year-olds and 17-year-olds that were behaviorally almost indistinguishable. The age didn't matter at all. What mattered was a certain psychographic profile. So if you study marketing and segmentation and actually dive into the literature on that, there are many ways to segment. There are many ways to carve up a hole into many different verticals. If your whole framework for carving things up is wrong, then you can't possibly reason about segments correctly. So this is one of these situations where you need strong opinions loosely held. We call it leap of faith assumption. You have to call them an assumption because you're going to act as if the assumption is true in order to find out what's really going on. So I strongly recommend you give yourself a time-limited window, and I'm talking like 6 weeks, where you say, we're going to act for the next 6 weeks as if this is the correct segmentation and this is our target segment. And we'll reconvene on a designated date, 6 weeks or 12, you pick the time horizon. On a certain day, we will have a pivot or persevere meeting where we will ask ourselves, now that we've worked really hard to achieve this segmentation and serve this segment, do we feel like we're on track? Does it seem like our analysis is holding up? And if the answer is yes, then we'll keep going for another 6 weeks. And the answer is no, maybe we'll reconsider a new segmentation then. But we don't allow ourselves ever to operate with no target, no hypothesis, no plan. It's much better to relentlessly and ferociously pursue a plan, even if it turns out to be wrong, because that'll help you figure out what the right plan is.
That's awesome. Cool.
Hey, Eric, this has been great. I've got one final question. So the Lean Startup Conference is coming up in December, Can you tell us a little bit about it and why everyone who hears this podcast or is reading this, the transcript, should attend?
Oh, that's very kind. Yes, we are having our premier conference we do every year here in San Francisco. It's the week of December 8th. For those who are trying to make a trip out of it or coming from long distances, we have a whole week's worth of programming you can attend. For those who are a little bit more local, maybe that's not the right thing. We, you know, the main conference is on 2 days. I think it's on the Tuesday and the Wednesday this year. And I feel like this is a one-of-a-kind startup conference. It is different than every other one that exists. There's no press. There's no launches, no hype. This is not a conference for rah-rah, pound your chest, launch your product, make a bunch of claims about things. It's a conference that is by entrepreneurs for entrepreneurs. So it's 100% focused on learning. And learning not through lecture and theory, but rather through case studies. So the vast majority of our speakers are practitioners who you probably are not going to hear from at any other conference. They're not professional speakers on the circuit doing motivational speeches. We work really hard all year long to identify entrepreneurs who you may not have ever heard of, but who have a very interesting story to tell and can talk about not how I made money 10 years ago, like a lot of entrepreneurs who speak, not what worked for me in the 80s, 90s, right? Like, here's what I am working on and struggling with right now, very recently. So while we do have some big names, and you can check our website, leanstartup.co, you can see all the all the big name folks will be there. Of course, we have workshops and in-depth programming as well. I think what makes us really unique is that we have like a truly diverse range of voices who are talking honestly and candidly about what entrepreneurship is really like. And the week of December 8th, I think one other thing to note is it's probably also the only conference where we have both garage entrepreneurs, venture-backed, like Silicon Valley-style entrepreneurs, and corporate entrepreneurs from big companies all in the same room at the same time. You know, we take an expansive view of what entrepreneurship is, people who are dealing with situations of high uncertainty, trying to create something new, and we don't discriminate based on who pays your bills and what kind of health insurance you have. So anyway, that's the Lean Startup Conference. I hope folks will join.
Awesome. Hey, again, thank you so much. This has been really helpful and instructive. Learned a ton from you, so thank you so much.
Appreciate it. These are great questions, and really, it's a pleasure.